Okay, well, good afternoon, everyone. I think that it's 5 o'clock, so we'll get started with a review of the 2013 final exam. So this is an exam where, as always, you have 2 hours for the exam. There's some formula sheets we'll be looking at, as well as a frequently asked question is, what will you be seeing in terms of Z and T tables? So you'll see all 5 pages of Z tables and the page of T, just as a security blanket. Okay, so we'll use this as a springboard for discussion. I'll just keep going through each question. Unless you have a question, raise your hand and we can have a little more discussion about it. But question one says, suppose that 2 characteristics are mutually exclusive. And so another tip that you might use when you look at a question like this would be, before looking at the answers, ask yourself what that question is talking about. So suppose 2 characteristics are mutually exclusive. Without even looking, you should say, cannot occur together. So if you indicate, you know, cannot occur together, then we look and we see that the probability of A or B, which is actually their union, one or the other or both, is 0. That would not be a characteristic of mutually exclusive. Conditional probability of A given B equals the probability of A equals the probability of A given not B. That would be a characteristic of independent. So that's not mutually exclusive. The probability of A and B equaling 1, the joint probability equals 1, is nonsensical. So that's not it in terms of defining mutually exclusive. Then we see the probability of A and B equals 0, which means their joint probability is 0. That's the correct one, because if 2 characteristics are mutually exclusive, they cannot occur together, and their joint probability is 0. And the last one is looking at the joint probability of A and B as the product of the two would be a characteristic of independence. So I think what we've seen is these responses B and E are characteristics of independence. Okay, so I just wanted to remind you, this is the second page of the formula page, and it is at the back of these old exams, so make sure that you look at it, because you'll want to see that it says population. It also has one that we're going to underline in bold a bit that says these are 1 sample situations and then 2 sample situations. So we'll be looking at this when we come through. Yes. Yes. Okay, so I think the question is, if we look at option B, this is saying your chance or probability of A is the same regardless of the presence of the other characteristic. So this maybe what you're asking is, should this have been reordered? Right, so I think you've often seen the probability of A given B is the same as the probability of A given not B, is the same as the overall probability of A. That's one way of writing, of showing that we have independence, because the probability of A does not depend on B. But simultaneously, I could have written the probability of B given A is equal to the probability of B given not A, is equal to the overall probability of B. And if A and B were independent, those two things would hold. Those two statements would be true. So yes, it's a little bit out of the order of what we typically see, but it still is B is a correct statement for independence, but not mutually exclusive. Okay, so we said remember the formula sheet. And so if we go on to number 2, we might go back to the formula sheet, because number 2 says, suppose a study in a sample of size 50 is performed. So I would say this means sample of size 50 means the sample size n, little n equals 50. The investigators report the standard error of the sample mean blood pressure. And so if we wanted to go back even to the formula page, we would say that if the sample mean is X bar, when we see this hypothesis test written out, we know that the denominator is referring to the standard error of the sample mean, and if we don't know sigma, so the standard error of the sample mean sigma x bar is sigma over the square root of n. When we don't know it, we estimate it by s of x bar, which gives us s over the square root of n. But the question is asking, what is this referring to? Variability in what? So since sigma is the variability of the measurements and n is the sample size, the standard error of the mean is representing variability in the possible values that x bar can take. So let's see how these responses work. So A says the variability in blood pressure in the underlying population from which the sample was drawn. What is that? That's sigma, so that's false. B, the variability in blood pressure in this particular sample of 50 individuals. That's S that we could calculate, so this is false. The variability in sample mean blood pressure over all possible samples of different sample sizes. What? We've not done that, so that's false. D, the variability in sample mean blood pressure over all possible samples of size square root of 50. That's false, because E is correct. The variability in sample mean blood pressures, meaning the X bars, across all possible samples of the same size, N equals 50. So when we draw that sampling distribution of X bar, sigma of X bar represents the standard error of the mean, of the sample mean, and it reflects variability in the X bars. Okay. So onward to three. Number three, which of the following is not? So I know you don't like these questions, but is not a feature of normal distributions. So A, normal distributions characterize the possible values and their relative probabilities for continuous random variables. Is that true of a normal distribution? That is true. That's true. So that's not a feature. B, they are symmetric. That's also true. The variance is equal to the proportion responding positively times 1 minus that number. That's looking very much like P times Q. So this is looking like this is false. D, they are fully characterized by only two parameters, the mean, mu, and the variance, sigma. That's true, right? Normal distribution is characterized by two parameters. So that's true. And E says any normal variable can be reproduced as the mean of its distribution plus or minus its standard deviation times the number of standard deviations it lies above or below the mean, which is another way of saying that you can transform any of these to a z, right? Transform any x to a z. So this is true. So the one that's false is the one that talks about variability with respect to proportions. So that would be false. C is false. Okay, moving on to four. The prevalence rate of tuberculosis in the U.S. is 3.2 cases per 100,000 in the year 2012. So first of all, we're seeing prevalence rate, keyword, rate, rate. And rate is equal to 3.2 cases per 100,000. Okay, so that's the rate. Then it says, assuming the same rate, what's the probability of observing one or more cases? So we're asking, what's the probability that X, the number of cases, is greater than or equal to 1? But a key thing here is it says, in the two-year time period, 2014 to 2015, so what was the time period in that first sentence about prevalence rate? It was 3.2 cases per 100,000 per 1 year. So now we're asked, what would this be if we had a two-year period? So we can take the rate, multiply it by a two-year period, and it also says it's not a town with 100,000. How many is there? How many people are in this town? 25,000. So we would multiply this by 25,000 people, And what would we see? We would see that we're taking a rate, which is 3.2 cases per 100,000 people per year, times a two-year period, so years cancel out, multiplied by 25,000 people, so the people cancel out, the units of people cancel out. And what are we left with? So it looks like we're left with 3.2 times 2, but 25,000 divided by 100,000 is 1/4. Yes? And so now we have 3.2 times 2 divided by 4, which is the same as 3.2 divided by 2, which boils down to saying in this two-year period, in a population of 25,000 individuals, how many cases would we expect to see? We'd expect lambda, which is 1.6 cases. Okay, so we're halfway there. We figured out what lambda is. This is sounding very much like what type of a distribution? A Poisson. Sounds like a Poisson. Where the question that we're asked is, what's the probability of observing one or more cases? So the probability that X is greater than or equal to 1. The easiest way to do this is to recognize that it's the same as 1 minus the probability that X equals 0. And I think we have almost everything we need, except maybe the formula. So we would look at the formula sheet, and we would say the Poisson says take e to the negative lambda, lambda to the x power, divided by x factorial. I mean, I happen to know that, but you don't need to memorize this. You have it on the formula page. So do we have everything that we need? I think so. So if lambda is 1.6, the probability that x equals 0 will be e to the negative 1.6, 1.6 raised to the 0 power all over 0 factorial. So most of this will reduce to e to the negative 1.6 times 1 divided by 1. And we should see something that looks pretty much like b. 1 minus e to the negative 1.6? 1 minus e to the negative 1.6. Okay, so far so good? So the only hold up on this question might have been to recognize you have a rate of cases per number of people in a one-year period. You have to multiply by 2 years for a two-year period and recognize that you only have a fourth of that number of people in the town, 25,000, so that the expected number of cases reduces to 1.6 in a two-year period. Okay, well, we're moving right along then, because now we're at number 5. And it says construction of a 95% bootstrap interval based on the difference between two sample means requires what? So the key is that it's talking about a bootstrap interval. So bootstrap interval, the key words you should think about are repeated sampling. Okay, so repeated sampling, another key word is without replacement. You are so good. With replacement. From the same sample, right? So from one sample that we're considering to be the truth. And so once you do that repeated sampling, you have x1 bar minus x2 bar many times, so thousands of times. So we have different samples because we're sampling, as you told me correctly, with replacement. People are eligible to be in the sample time and time again. And then what are we doing? Are we sampling with replacement of repeated samples of the same sizes from the original two samples? That's exactly what we're doing. Let's see why the other ones are wrong. Sampling without replacement of repeated samples of different large sample sizes from the original two samples. So two things are wrong there. Without replacement is wrong, and different large sample sizes makes this false. C, the assumption that the sample sizes are large and the central limit theorem holds. So that's not, bless you, That's not talking about bootstrap interval. That's talking about a sampling distribution. So if the sample sizes are large enough, the central limit theorem holds, and the distribution of the statistic, which in this case is x1 bar minus x2 bar, would be approximately normal. So that is not a bootstrap interval. The next one, the assumption that sampling is based on sampling without replacement from underlying normal distributions for the two populations. Are there any assumptions about distributional form in the bootstrap? There are none. There are none. So this is false. Bootstrap doesn't require any assumptions. And E, the assumptions that the variances are equal in the underlying two populations, that might be an assumption for something else, but it's not the assumption for the bootstrap. So this would also be false. Okay. Here's matching. Number 6. Match each of the following terms with appropriate definitions. Fill in one letter for each term. So let's just do A and see what it matches with in terms of these five items that are listed. So A says the probability of rejecting the null hypothesis. So I'm writing this as a conditional probability. Probability of rejecting null hypothesis given or when the null hypothesis is true. That's alpha. So alpha goes along with A. The probability of failing to reject. So failing to reject the null hypothesis when it is true. So that's a good thing, isn't it? Failing to reject the null hypothesis when it's actually true. So that's 1 minus alpha. So it's 1 minus the significance level. C, the probability of obtaining a sample result as extreme or more extreme than the one observed under the assumption or if the null hypothesis were true is p-value. So we've had some discussion about what does it mean, this extreme or more extreme, right? So it means if your test statistic was x1 bar minus x2 bar, and we have hypothesized something about the center of that sampling distribution, for instance, that it's equal to zero, we're asking how likely is it that we would observe the actual difference that we saw, say 28 or something bigger, meaning in the right tail, or just by the luck of the draw, negative 28 or something smaller. So we're trying to look at how likely is it that we would get that value or something. So some people today were saying, what's another way of saying that? This value or something more unusual, this value or something more unusual in either tail. So one can think of extreme as being in the tails, more unusual. But we said that was the p-value. And then D, the probability of rejecting the null hypothesis when the specific alternative hypothesis, HA, is true. So is that a good thing, rejecting the null when the alternative is actually true? That's what we want, and that's what's referred to as power. So statistical power is 1 minus beta. And the last one, the probability of failing to reject the null hypothesis when the specific alternative, HA, is true, that's the mistake we would make that's called beta, the probability of a type 2 error. Okay, yes. Right, so for a one-sided test, suppose that our null hypothesis was that mu 1 minus mu 2 is less than or equal to 0. So then what's the alternative? So we have to have equality in the null. So the alternative would be that mu 1 minus mu 2 is greater than 0. So let's see how we would set up this rejection region. Here's the rejection region. I'm drawing a normal curve for x1 bar minus x2 bar. It's centered at 0 because that's how we're anchoring this sampling distribution. So we can calculate probabilities and look at rejection regions. The null says that the difference in the true means is 0 or something less. So the rejection region is on what side? So it's all in the right tail. We would put all of the alpha in the right tail, so 0.05 would be all in that right tail. And then, how would we calculate the p-value or understand this? What's the probability of observing something this extreme or more extreme in a one-sided test? So again, I'll give the example. Suppose that we have 28 is a value that's way out here in the right tail. So the probability would be, the p-value would be the probability of getting a difference in sample means that's greater than or equal to 28, and it's just one tail. So we would calculate just that one-sided p-value. Now, here's where it might get more confusing. What if you didn't observe 28? What if you actually observed negative 4? Right? Suppose you observed negative 4. So now, in a one-sided test, the p-value is actually the probability of getting negative 4 or something larger, more extreme, in just that one direction. Does that make sense? So it depends on how your null and alternative are set up, and it depends on where your observed test statistic or sample statistic falls. So if it had fallen in the right tail where the rejection region is, it's going to be a very small number, just less than 0.05, but in one tail. If it falls in the other direction, basically be in the opposite direction of what we expected, then it's going to be a higher p-value. Okay, any other questions about that before we move into a scenario? Okay, hearing no questions then, let's go on. Okay. Right, so we were talking about, this wasn't really referring to number 6 at all, but it was talking about p-values. And often when we're calculating two-sided p-values, we're looking at what's the probability of being this value or something in the tail, more extreme. Question was, how do you calculate the p-value when you have a one-sided test? And remember that the reason we're setting this up as a one-sided test is because we have some reason to do so. We have some reason to think that the difference in means is greater than zero, because what we love to do is reject the null in favor of the alternative. So if our null is that the difference is zero or something less, then we're expecting, we're hoping that our data will allow us to reject this and conclude that the difference is in the other direction. So I had originally had an observed difference in sample means of 28, where it's pretty clear that the p-value will just be the probability of the difference in sample means being 28 or something bigger. But if we actually had observed a difference of negative 4, the one-sided p-value is going to be the probability that the difference in sample means is greater than or equal to negative 4. And that's because of the way this is set up. If this had been set up in the other direction, I don't want to belabor this, but shall we belabor it a minute? Okay. Thank you, Sarah. Trying to do is emphasize that we've set this up as a null is at zero or something less, and the alternative is greater. I'm going to use a different color to allow us to see that if the null hypothesis had been that the difference in means is greater than or equal to zero, and the alternative was the difference in true population means is less than zero, then where would the rejection region be? All the alpha would be in what I'm highlighting in blue, which is on the left side. So if we observed a negative 4 that went along with that specification of the null and the alternative, then the p-value would be the probability that the difference in sample means is less than or equal to negative 4, because that corresponds to the direction that we've set up the null and the alternative. But in red, the p-value would be the probability of being greater than or equal to negative 4, because we've set up a null hypothesis that the difference in means is less than or equal to 0 versus an alternative that it's greater. Okay, so I belabored that a little bit for those who were interested. But it all depends on the setup. All depends on the setup. Okay, shall we go on to the scenario then that we have with questions 7 through 18? 7 through 18 concern the sample of 97 elderly individuals. So right away, you know, ding, 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 right? We have a sample, so that means N equals 97 elderly individuals defined as age 85 years or older who are enrolled in the Sleep Heart Health Study, a longitudinal study designed to investigate associations between sleep behavior and cardiovascular disease. So the outcome of interest is self-reported Epworth Sleepiness Scale, we'll just call it ESS, by sex. So what individuals do is they rate their probability of falling asleep on a scale that goes from 0, none, 1, low, 2, moderate, and 3, high for 8 different questions. So it's summed up, and it has a range that goes from 0 to 4. So once we've added all of these up as a scale, this Epworth score is sort of similar to a quality of life scale or some other scale, which now, how do we continue this, consider this? What type of variable? Say that again? Well, it certainly was ordinal when it was 0, 1, 2, 3 for 8 different questions, but once we've added these together, we're going to handle it as a continuous variable. So it has this spread. So we're going to handle it as a continuous variable. And we know that what we're told is higher scores are more predictive of daytime sleepiness. So a higher score on this scale will possibly be related with sleeping disorders. So here are the data. So we see some summary statistics. First, we see this by sex. So when sex is equal to 0 in this data set, we have females. And we're just looking at elderly people, so that's why this says some ESS if age is greater than or equal to 85. And we see all sorts of things, percentiles, smallest and largest numbers, means, standard deviations, anything we'd like to see. And we see it as well for males. Okay, so let's look at number 7, which is asking us to look at males and to answer a question like this. Suppose that we use these data to construct a box and whisker plot of the ESS scores for males. So this is bolded for a reason, because it says just look at males, right? Not females, just males. Which of the following is not correct? So I think before I would look at this, I would try to construct my box and whisker plot, which I can do pretty easily because we have our percentiles. So Q1 is the 25th percentile, which is 4. Q2 is 8, the 50th percentile, and Q3 is 12. And in fact, look, they're equidistant, so we actually drew this correctly. 4, 8, and 12. So now, if we looked at these questions, we would say, do 50%, now we have to read this, I'm going to go back and read this correctly, and this is what you should do in an exam. Don't skip ahead like I just did, because we have to read which of the following is not correct. So 50% of the ESS scores range between the values of 4 and 12. That's true, because that's the middle 50%. 50% of the ESS scores fall at or below 8. It's the median, so that's true. 25% of the ESS scores fall at or above 4. That's false, and that's false because actually this would have been correct if this had said 75%. Let's just play out the next two. 75% of the ESS scores fall at or below 12. That's true, that by definition of the third quartile. And 50% of the ESS scores fall at or above 8. By definition of median, that's also true. So the answer that's incorrect is C. This is not correct because it would have been correct if it said 75% of ESS scores fall at or above 4. Okay, so here is a non-calculation question. The quality of sleep individuals experience differs from day to day due to environmental and biological or medical factors. What consequence of this fact, meaning this variability, is reflected in the distribution of ESS scores? So the fact that there's some influence of environment, biology, and medical factors, is this associated with a positive bias? What would a bias mean? Right, bias would mean that there would be the measurement is different from the truth. So this is not a bias, neither positive nor negative. Would there be decreased dispersion because of these influences of other factors? If anything, we'd expect it to be increased. So that would be false. Is it measurement variation? It would be measurement variation only if we were told that there was some instrument that was used to quantify the quality of sleep that created measurement variation. So the fact that it's fluctuating due to environmental and biologic or medical factors is due to natural variation. So it's variability that's explained by this random or natural variation. Okay, then we're moving on to number 8. But it's really 9. It's really 9. So number 9 says, assume that the ESS score is normally distributed in the population of males. So this is a huge statement, isn't it? Assume that ESS score, that's our random variable X of interest, assume it's distributed normally in the population of males. So the question asks, what values of the ESS score span the middle 50% of the population distribution? So you're given a hint, use the sample statistics to approximate the corresponding population parameters in your calculation. So we're seeing lots of words about population, right? Population distribution. So we're looking at the population distribution of this random variable X ESS score. So what's the mean? The mean would be mu, and the standard deviation would be sigma in those scores. But do we know mu and sigma? No. But we do know X bar, which is 7.81, that's our best estimate of mu. We do know that. And what else do we know? We know S, the standard deviation of 4.73, which is our best estimate of sigma. So if you were asked, how do you calculate this range for the middle 50% of ESS scores? Can we do some estimation from the sample statistics? I think we can. We're going to estimate sigma by S, so we'll use 4.73. What are we estimating mu to be? 7.8, we'll say 1. Okay, this is in terms of points on that score. So I know right away that I could say that the middle 68% would be within plus or minus one standard deviation. But this is not asking for the middle 50%, it's 68%. What am I even talking about? Middle what? 50%. The question is asking for the middle 50%. So there's a couple of things that we could think about. We could say if we got the middle 68%, just because we know about this, this would have been 7.81 plus or minus 1 standard deviation times 4.73. Okay. And what we know is that the middle 68% are going to be in a narrower range. Yeah. Okay. And we, in fact, have tables. We can look up the Z table to see how many standard deviations is it for the middle 50%. It would be associated with the Z that has 0.25. in the tail in the B column. If you look that up, you're going to see that that's 0.65 on the Z table. You may have done this in a problem or self-evaluation or just look in the Z table now. Right? So does it make sense that if you have 0.25 in one tail, that's 0.65 standard deviations from the mean? Okay. So what we really want to do is 7.81 plus or minus 0.65 times this estimate of standard deviation of 4.73. And I think that looks very much like C. But our question might be, why are these other ones wrong? Right? Why are they wrong? Or what might they answer? Does everybody agree with these two statements on the bottom? The middle 68% would be 7.81 plus or minus 1 times S, 4.73, because S is estimating sigma? Right, so that's the question. Why are we not using the standard error of the mean? So the reason we're not using the standard error of the mean is because what is this question about? It's about the population measures of the ESS score. So our random variable is X. It's not X bar. So if we wanted to use the standard error of the mean, which would take 4.73 over the square root of the sample size of 43, it would be a different question. And that question would be, so we'll make this up, but what would that question be? So a new question that answers D would be approximate the corresponding range associated with the middle 50%, and so it's sounding very similar, isn't it? Middle 50% of sample means associated with samples, all possible samples taken of size 43. Mm-hmm. So it'd have to be a different question. It would have to be one in which X bar is the random variable of interest, not X. So we're talking about population scores here. Yes. All right, so the question was, when we talk about X bar being our best estimate of mu, we call that mu hat or X bar, it's our maximum likelihood estimate, the best estimate based on the observed data. And S is our best estimate of sigma, so we'll call it sigma hat, our best estimate or maximum likelihood estimate of the true population parameter based on the data. That's right. Okay, question? Right, so the question was, why aren't we using, say, a table T statistic, or is that what you're asking, to take into account the degrees of freedom that go with that sample size? Or are you asking, why is it not answer D? Of a particular sample, that's right.
And so,
4.727, which I'm rounding to 4.73? Yes. So. Sure. So I can explain why when we're talking about just the values of the Epworth sleepiness score, we're saying that's our random variable. That's our random variable X in a population of measures. And if we had the true population, we would have a mu, the true population mean, and we'd have a spread in the values of those measures, which would be sigma, the true population spread. But we don't have the population information, so we're doing the best we can do using the point estimates from our single sample. So the best estimate of the true mu is given by X bar. The best estimate of the true sigma is given by S. And the reason why we're not using sigma over the square root of N is because this would be answering the question of, if we had the random variable representing the statistic, X bar, the sample mean, then we know that the spread in the possible values it can take, sigma of X bar, is sigma over the square root of n. So the distinction is, the question is asking for the distribution of the x's, the ESS values. It's a different question to talk about the distribution of the possible sample means. And we could estimate sigma over the square root of n by S, 4.73 over the square root of 43, but then we'd be talking about the variability in the sample means, and we could answer a question like, what's the range for the middle 50% of sample means that we could get if we sampled all possible samples of size 43? It's a different question. This is key, so I'm willing to stay here as long as you want to differentiate between this, but the question itself is saying ESS is normally distributed. The random variable of the Epworth score is normally distributed about some mean mu and a standard deviation sigma that we don't know. So our estimate of sigma will be the sample standard deviation that we get from our single sample, and the best estimate of mu is X bar from our single sample. But it's a very different question when we move this into the distribution of a statistic such as X bar, D bar, X1 bar minus X2 bar, P hat, etc. So the aim is to distinguish between what is the question asking about, a population distribution and estimating it, or is it asking about the sampling distribution? Right, so the question was, I had thought that this was going more towards why are we using our tabled values from the Z table? And the reason that I was using Z's instead of a T was here we were just trying to approximate this population distribution. I'm not doing a hypothesis test. I'm not setting up a confidence interval. I'm really just trying to estimate the middle 50% of the range of Epworth scores based on the best we know about our estimated mean in the population and our estimated standard deviation. Yeah. That's right. So it's the same. So the question is, and then I'm going to move on to the next one. But the question was, how I went through to reason the fact that I could create the middle 50%, this middle 50%, by finding out what table Z would give me the middle 50%, meaning 25% in each tail. So I looked up this value of 0.65. I could have also said, well, X1 is going to be equal to So X1 minus mu over sigma would be equal to the lower limit of the Z, which we know was 0.65. And what's the other one? X1 plus mu over sigma. I think I'm messing this up. Wait just a minute. Sorry. So what's the Z statistic? So I took this from an X to a Z by skipping a step, but I didn't need to. I could have gone through that step to recognize that on the Z scale, we're looking at 0.65 as being the number of standard deviations above the mean that gives me 0.25 in one tail, and then negative 0.65 would give us what? 0.25 in the lower tail. I'm interested in the middle 50%. So if the table Z is 0.65, I can solve for what the X1 would be and X2 by saying that Z of negative 0.65 is going to equal X1 minus mu over sigma, and I'm estimating mu and sigma. And I also know that X2, the upper bound, would equal positive 0.65. And that would So I'm sorry I'm saying X2 because what is it actually? You know, I'm going to insert a slide, and we'll just do this real quick because... So the main issue was differentiating between the sampling distribution of X bar and the population distribution of X. That's what I was getting at when I was spending the time down here. Now we've gone into saying, was there another way in which we could have calculated this? And the other way is this. So if we know that we're looking for a lower limit, I'll call X1, and an upper limit that I'll call X2 for this Epworth sleepiness scale, and we're asking what is that range that gives us the middle 50%? We know that we can use this by also looking at the Z distribution, in which we also have 0.25 in each tail, and that's associated with a tabled Z of positive 0.65 or negative 0.65. So the question is, what's X1 and X2? So if Z is equal to negative 0.65, then it's going to also be equal to X1 minus mu over sigma. And I'll call this Z1. Z2 is equal to positive 0.65, which is X1 minus mu over sigma. And if you solve, but it's X2, if you solve for X1 and X2, what you end up getting is exactly what I wrote down here, which is that you take the mean plus or minus 0.65 times sigma, or its estimate, which is 4.73. Either way. Okay. So let's go on then to number 10. Number 10, are we ready for this? Okay. So number 10, for this question, and you can see actually this says, for this question only, underline that, this question only, assume, bolded, that the true population standard deviation of ESS scores is known to be 5 in elderly men. So what does that tell us? We're told to assume that sigma equals 5 points. And now it says, conduct a test of a null hypothesis that the mean ESS in the elderly men population is no greater than 8. So that means less than or equal to 8 versus an alternative in which the mean is greater than 8. Does that make sense how we translated that? The null is no greater than 8, meaning less than or equal to 8. The alternative is that the mean is greater than 8. So we're asked to construct the test statistic and calculate the p-value. So what do we know about the number of men? 43. What do we know about the sample mean? 7.81. And we're told that sigma is equal to 5. So the test statistic, Z or a T. So since we're told sigma is 5, it's a Z. So Z is going to be equal to X bar minus the hypothesized value, which is centered at 8. Right? So we're hypothesizing that the mean is less than or equal to 8 versus an alternative that is greater. So our significance, our alpha all goes in one tail. So the Z is X bar. And our sample statistic is X bar because that's what we're able to calculate from the data. So we're taking X bar minus the hypothesized value over the standard error of X bar. Does that make sense? What's our statistic? If we're testing about means, our a single mean mu, our sample statistic has to be X bar. How might I remind myself about this? Oh, what happened to that? Wow. That was the formula page. Ooh, okay. We might have another one. Wow, okay. So, well, I would suggest that you look at the formula page, which really became black here. So if you look at the formula page that's on page 2 that conveniently just became blacked out, what we would have seen on this page is that under where it said one sample, you'd have a null hypothesis. If you look at that formula page yourself, you'd have a null hypothesis that the mean equals some value versus the alternative that it's not equal to mu naught, that value. And if you know sigma, then it's a z, which takes x bar minus the hypothesized value over sigma over the square root of n. So one way of studying is to say, yes, if I'm hypothesizing about an individual population mean, what's my test? My test statistic is going to be based on the sample statistic x bar, and the standard error of x bar is what is going to be in the denominator. So I would definitely look at that formula page, even though we can't see it right now. Sarah?
So when you're doing hypothesis testing, you'll use the square root of n and use the standard error?
Right. So when we're doing hypothesis testing about a mean based on x bar, we're going to use the standard error of x bar in both the hypothesis test and the confidence interval. And we're going to do the same when we're looking at testing hypotheses about population means based on x1 bar minus x2 bar. It's always the corresponding standard error. So I'm sorry that that went away. We could try to bring it back maybe a little bit later. But where we are with number 10 is setting up that z statistic. So we're hypothesizing that the mean is less than or equal to 8. What are we using? The sample statistic of x bar, which is equal to 7.81. So this z statistic takes 7.81 minus the hypothesized value, that's 8, and divides by sigma over the square root of n. But what is sigma? Sigma, we're told, is 5. The square root of n is 43. And so what we would have to do is actually calculate this z statistic. So some of you may have done that. So I'm getting minus 0.12. So what that is allowing us to say is that if our sample statistic is 7.81, is that close to the hypothesized value? Looks pretty close. So we're calculating this probability, which when we transform to a z, is looking at what's the probability of getting a z of negative 0.12 or something more extreme. But it's a one-sided test, so it's just one tail. Just one tail. Yes? Did I do this wrong? Okay, did everybody get as far as z equals 7.81 minus 8 divided by 5 over the square root of 43? And so you're saying that I might have messed up on the math here? So 7.81 minus 8 is about negative 0.19. 5 divided by the square root of 43 is about 0.76. And so then if I go through a little bit of math, I'm actually getting negative 0.25. Is that what you got now? Okay, verified. Good. Thank you. But in other words, all that we're doing is erasing the fact that the probability or area under the curve to the left of 7.81 under the sampling distribution is the same as under a z, the probability of getting a z of negative 0.25 or something less. So what's the p-value? The p-value is literally this. What's the probability of getting a z that's less than negative 0.25? We know that in the B column, positive 0.25 is tabled. Yeah? So what did you get? So actually what we would want to do is what we want is the probability of Z being less than negative 0.25, but we recognize that what is tabled is the probability of Z being greater than 0.25. They're symmetric. It's by symmetry, we're looking at the probability in the right tail is the same as the probability in the left. So if you don't have your Z tables with you, it would be good for us to look at this. So here's the Z table. So we're looking at Z of 0.25 in the right. So I'm looking here in the B column, that value looks to be about 0.4, 0.40. Is that one of the responses? So because of symmetry, the probability of being to the left is the same as the probability of being to the right. So we would go back to this and say that this is approximately 0.4. Except that, did you all get negative 0.25? Okay, sorry. It is the other way. So remember when we were setting this up before? Do you remember that? It's a one-sided test. It's a one-sided test. So what we're really concerned about with this one-sided test is not this part. So I'm going to get rid of this right now. So we said that this Z was equal to negative. Okay, let's stay together for a second, then we're going to move on. We said that this Z was equal to negative 0.25. Is that right? Okay. So now we said under this Z distribution, negative 0.25 is here. It's here. This is zero. This is the Z. So now the p-value that we're asking for is going to be associated with this one-sided test. So where's the rejection region? To the right. So where do I have to calculate this probability, which is different than what I did before? So we need to recognize that because the rejection region on a one-sided test is to the right, we're looking at the probability of Z being greater than negative 0.25. So that would be 1 minus 0.4, which is 0.6. So that's exactly right, that it is 1 minus that because it's a one-sided test in this other direction.
So we have 0.6 because it's attached for the null hypothesis.
Right, we're saying if the null hypothesis is true, yeah, and the null is true that the mean is 8 or something less, what's the chance that you would get basically 7.81 or something more extreme, which means in which direction? So 7.81 is just to the left of 8, 7.81. So we're asking, what's the chance that you would get 7.81 or something more extreme?
And attached for the alternative hypothesis.
Right.
The other path.
So well, we never do tests for alternative hypotheses. We're always calculating the p-value under the assumption that the null is the one that's true. So I'm sorry I messed up on this, but this is what is tricky about one-sided tests. So where was the rejection region? Rejection region is to the right. When we define what's extreme or more extreme, we're looking in the direction of the rejection region, whether we're on a two-sided test or a one-sided test. So on a one-sided test, where's the rejection region for this particular case? It's to the right. So we're looking at the probability of X bar being greater than or equal to 7.81, which we said is the same as the probability of Z being greater than negative 0.25, which is why we're looking at subtracting out the tail, which was a probability of 0.4, and it gives us the overall probability of 0.6. Yep. One last question on this? No, well, so it says, for this question only, assume that the true population standard deviation is here. So whenever you conduct a test of a null hypothesis, you're dealing with sample data. So you know that a test of a null hypothesis is based on sample data. So that's why we have X bar for the males is 7.81. Okay, let's see how we can do with number 11. Something different, number 11. So 11 says, now dichotomize Epworth score as low. If the Epworth score is less than 14, so low is going to say Epworth score is less than 14, and high is if this score is greater than or equal to 14. So now we're asked, based on this data, based on the data above, is the Epworth score independent of sex? So if we had males and females, and if we had low and high Epworth score, so you can sort of see this visually in a 2x2 table, we could ask if they were independent, then the probability, for instance, of being in a low score would be the same in males as it is in females. So I could write the conditional probability of being low given you're a male is the same as the probability of being low given you're a female. Is that true? So we have some data. Let's see if we can go about figuring this out. So we said 14 was a cut point. So do you notice 14 for males? So what fraction are below 14 for males? 90%? What fraction are below 14 for females? Where'd those females go? So 14 is 90%. So 90% for females and also 90% for males. So if I asked you what's the chance of having a low Epworth score, you would say it would be 0.9 for males, and it's also 0.9 for females. So a suggestion that Epworth scale is independent of sex. So I think we just answered that. We said, yes, they're independent, and now we have to figure out which of these ones is correct. So I'd say let's get rid of the no's because we just said they're independent. They have the same probability. So yes, because high Epworth score given you're a female is the same as high Epworth score given you're a male. So independence means the probability of being in characteristic A is the same regardless of characteristic B. So this is not how we would assess independence. We could have looked at the probability of a high score among males and the probability of high scores. Oh, boy. Sorry. I'm glad you're looking at me funny. Okay. So let's ask this another. How many possibilities do we have? We have two possibilities. So I happen to look at the probability of low given you're a male. What's the probability of high given you're a male? 10%. What's the probability of high given you're a female? It's also 10%. So whether we looked at these conditional probabilities as low given the particular sex or high given the particular sex, they're the same. So A is correct. The probability of high Epworth given you're a female is the same as the probability of high Epworth score given you're a male. Let's see if something's wrong with C. This says yes because the probability of female among those with low Epworth is the same as the probability of male among those with low Epworth. So this is why this is not a way of assessing, because what's different in these two? So it's conditioning on the same thing as opposed to looking at the probability of characteristic A among those with a condition versus characteristic A among those without the condition. So you were all looking at me correctly that A is the right answer. Conditional probabilities are the same. So now we're going to see that something looks like pre-midterm with binomial days. right? So number 12 says, suppose four older adults were randomly selected from that overall group in table 1. So that means the sample size n equals 4. What's the probability that two or fewer were female or had high Epworth scores? So this is underlined. It has an or in it. So this is looking like what sort of a rule should we use? The probability of being female or having high Epworth scores. So in order to answer this question about what's the probability that two or fewer had this characteristic, we have to figure out what's P. And P is the probability of being female or having high Epworth scores. Okay, do we have enough data to do this? I think so. Let's look at females and males and low and high Epworth and see if we can figure this out. So should we do a 2x2 table? How many females? I have to go back and look. How many females? 54. And what percent had high Epworth scores? 10%. 10% of 54? 10% of 54 had high, so I'd say that's 5.4. Yeah. So how many did not? Looks like what, 44.6? We know that we don't have fractions of people, but we're setting this up as a 2x2 table. Okay. Are you okay with that? You're not okay with that because you don't want a fraction? Or are you not okay with my math? So 54, we said that Epworth score for... So wasn't 14 the cutoff? So this is saying that 90% are 14 or below, 10% are above. So high would be 10% of 54, which is 5.4. I think that's right. That's because I'm really not adding right. Thank you. Yes. So 48.6 plus 5.4 gives 54. Thank you. So we had 43 males, of whom also 10% were in the high group. So that was 4.3. And so now we need to do a little bit of math. 43 minus 4.3 is 38.7. Okay, this is looking good, looking good. So can we, but I drew this over here, and I wanted to draw it here. No problem. No problem. You told me how many females were there? 54? And how many males? 43. And how many were high? 4.3. Okay. So, and what's the overall total? 97. Okay. Can we figure out what the probability is of being female or high ESS? We can do it just from the table. So we know that there's 54 females, and we'll fill this out. So it's 48.6. 54 females. How many with high ESS? 9.7. How many had both? 5.4. So this probability should be 54 plus 9.7 minus 5.4 all over 97. So we're taking total female, total high, subtract the double counting. So that probability should be something that looks like, did you get 0.6? Do I have a third? So if P is 0.6, then Q is 0.4. And our question is, what's the probability of having the number in this group being less than or equal to 2. So it seems like we're going to have the probability that x equals 0 plus the probability that x equals 1 plus the probability that x equals 2. So I think we can cancel some of these out right away. This one that's E is only the probability that x equals 2. Two of these are not taking into account any other combinations. What's B? B would actually be the probability that x is less than or equal to 2. No? No. The P and Q's are wrong. Right. So this is wrong because it's the wrong P and the wrong Q. But C is correct. C is correct. But we could write this another way, couldn't we? We could have written this as 1 minus the probability of x equals 3, 1 minus the probability that x equals 3 or 4. So I'll just write that as probability of x being greater than or equal to 3. So either way, either sum them or take 1 minus the probability that x equals 3 plus the probability that x equals 4. But definitely wrong P and Q in item B. Okay, now we're still on this scenario, but not for too much longer. So here it's saying, suppose that all possible samples of size 54 could be taken for females aged 85 or greater. And in this question 13, it's saying, again, define a high ESS score as 14 or greater, assuming that the population proportion with high ESS is 0.1, what's the probability of obtaining a sample proportion of high ESS scores equal to 0.05 or larger? So let's read each of these sentences, starting with the second one. It says, assume the population proportion with high is 0.1. So this is really our null hypothesis, is that P is equal to 0.1, and it's asking, what's the probability of obtaining a sample proportion, meaning P hat, that's equal to 0.05 or larger? So greater than or equal to 0.05. So we're dealing with the sampling distribution of P hat, and we know that its mean will be equal to P, which we're hypothesizing is 0.1. And what's its standard error? So it's going to depend on P and Q and N. But if we're hypothesizing that P is 0.1, we're also hypothesizing that Q is 0.9, and the standard error would be based on 0.1 times 0.9 over 54. So can we transform this to a Z? So the probability of getting a sample proportion greater than or equal to 0.05 transform to a Z by taking P hat minus the hypothesized value divided by the square root of the hypothesized P naught, Q naught over N. That will now be our Z. But what we have to do is subtract 0.1 from the right-hand side. So we have 0.05 minus 0.1 divided by the square root of 0.1 times 0.9 over 54. So ultimately, we write this as the probability of Z being greater than, and we have to do a little bit of calculation. So if we took 0.05 minus 0.1, we get negative 0.05 in the numerator. And in the denominator, we take 0.1 times 0.9 divided by 54. And if I continue through the math, I get negative 1.22, and that should be the same as A. Right? The probability of Z being greater than negative 1.22. So it's saying, if the truth was 0.1, what's the chance that we would get a sample proportion of 0.05 or bigger? and that probability is probably that Z is bigger than negative 1.22. So a fairly high probability. Okay, so a few more that are based on those same data. So the following is this data output that is assessing the difference in mean. Whoops. I missed a question. Thank you. I missed 14. Should I go to 14? Okay. So 14 says, in figure 1 is displayed a quantile-quantile plot of ESS scores in males versus females. So this is looking at the observed data for males versus females. We know that this line of agreement, Y equals X, is where the quantiles would be exactly the same in both groups. And if they were, then we would say that males and females either have the same distribution identically, right, no matter what that distribution might look like, they would have the same exact quantiles. So what do you notice here? These are all the observed points that are representing the first quantile in males versus the first quantile in females versus males. So we see all of these different points. Are they on that line of agreement? So they're shifted up. So that would say they're at least shifted in location, with it being higher in males than females. But is it exactly parallel? So it seems to diverge a bit. So it would seem that not only are these different in mean, but they're also different in variability. So let's look at these. A, the ESS scores appear to be normally distributed in both males and females. This isn't quantile versus normal. It's a QQ plot, so we can't even assess that. The ESS distributions for females and males are identical. No, because we'd expect them to all those points to fall on the straight line. Only the variance of ESS appears to differ for males and females. So we see that it's shifted in location above that line, so it's not just the variance. Both the mean and variance appear to be different. I would say that's the winner, because we see that the points are above the straight line, indicating a shift, higher quantiles in males than females, but also a dispersion, because we're seeing that it's not exactly parallel. And the last one says, the ESS score appears to be normally distributed only in females. We'd only be able to assess that if we had a Q-norm plot in which we plotted the quantiles versus normal. So we can't assess that. Okay. So here is number 15, and I think this data output go with this. So based on the 54 women aged 85 and older in this study, the 95% confidence interval for the mean ESS score in the population is given on page 7, and it ranges from 5.97, so we could just write this, 5.97 points up to 8.40 points. The correct interpretation of this confidence interval is what? So is the probability 0.95 that the interval will overlap the mean ESS for older women? Sorry. Let's read that again, right? The probability is 0.95 that the interval will overlap the mean ESS score for women 85 years and older, one states under a null hypothesis. So this doesn't sound like a very grammatically correct phrase. But what's the matter with this phrase, even if it's non-grammatical? So does the confidence interval have anything to do with a statement or assumption of a null hypothesis? No. We construct it based on the data. So that's not correct. We have 95% confidence in this interval in the following sense. Upon repeated sampling, if we could do that, approximately 95% of constructed confidence intervals will overlap the true mean ESS for older women? That is true. So we have two interpretations of confidence intervals. We say we do a study, we calculate our confidence interval. If this was our confidence interval, I'd say I'm 95% confident that this interval overlaps the truth. But we also know if we were to take repeated samples of the same size and construct 95% confidence intervals from all of those samples, 95 out of 100 of them would overlap the truth, and 5 out of 100 would not. So this is that second definition, that in repeated sampling, 95% of the intervals will overlap the true mean ESS scores for older individuals. Yes? Right, right. So the question that's being asked is, what if I said, this is totally separate from this question, what if I said I'm 95% confident that the sample mean is included in this interval? I'm 95% confident that this interval includes the sample mean. So the sample mean, plus or minus the table T or Z times the standard error, is what gives you the confidence interval. So how confident am I that X bar is in the interval? I'm 100% confident because it has to be. It forms the basis of the interval. So that's a different question. But we do have a couple of other ones. C is just saying upon repeated sampling, only 5% of the intervals would overlap the truth. So that's gotten it a little bit backwards. It's 95%. And then D and E say the probability is 0.95 that the true mean is included in the interval. The probability is 0.95 that the sample mean is included in the interval. So E is actually the one that we would say. We could say probability is 1 that the sample mean is included in the interval. But this phrase, the probability is 0.95 that the true mean is included in the interval, the true mean is fixed. So the true mean is either in the interval or not. So what it is, the random part is that we can say the probability is 0.95 that the interval overlaps the truth or contains the truth. The interval is what's random. The truth is fixed. So this D would also be wrong. It could be fixed if we said the probability is 0.95 that the confidence interval contains or overlaps the true mean ESS score. Boy, this scenario really goes on, doesn't it? Like goes on and on. Now we're on number 16. So suppose the significance level alpha was set up for a two-sided test of the null hypothesis that the difference in population means equals zero versus the alternative that the difference in population means is not equal to zero. Now the good news is we're going to interpret the stata output and we're going to try to see whether we assume equal variances or equal means or whatever is being asked here. So let's see if we can find that output, which I think I had placed here. So the very first thing, if you have a null hypothesis about means, you have another parameter to worry about, and that is standard deviation. So our first step is to actually test the hypothesis that we see here, that the ratio of the means equals 1. Another way to write that is that sigma 1 squared over sigma 2 squared equals 1. In other words, sigma 1 squared equals sigma 2 squared, right? If the ratio of two variances in the population equals 1, then the two variances have to equal each other. So let's do the eyeball test. We're going to look at the standard deviations, 4.43, 4.72. Similar or different? Our eyeballs are usually right. So the eyeball says these look pretty similar. How about the test statistic? So we know there's a calculated test statistic. We're only concerned with the p-value. So our p-value of 0.66 is much bigger than 0.05. So what does this say? You know, we fail to reject the null. And what do we conclude? Equal or unequal variances? Equal. So we'll conclude that it appears that we are sampling from populations that have equal variances. So then we'll go to the next output, and we'll see that we have one t-test command that assumes equal variance and another one that assumes unequal variance. So the one we want to use is equal. So we can see here that this t-test is setting up a null hypothesis that mu1 minus mu2, the difference in population means, equals zero, and the alternative is that mu1 minus mu2 is not equal to zero. That's what we see in this middle section of the output. Now, we have to search around a little bit. We can do a few things. We can see that if we looked at the observed t statistic that takes x1 bar minus x2 bar minus 0 over a standard error that pools the variances, this t statistic data puts over here in the corner, negative 0.6734. Where did that come from? Takes the difference in the sample means, negative 0.628 minus 0, and then divides by the standard error that Stata calculated for us, assuming pooled variances, 0.933. What does that equal? Negative 0.673. The p-value is quite high, 0.5. So do you reject or fail to reject this hypothesis of equal population means? So our data seem to support the hypothesis of equal means. Let's look at the eyeball test. Do those sample means look similar? 7.18, 7.8. Best to do a statistical test, but they look similar. So if we go back to question 16, so we saw that there was no statistically significant difference and our p-value was point, do you remember what it was? 0.5023. So I would vote for assuming equal variances in the two populations of males and females, there's no statistically significant difference in mean ESS score between males and females, p-value 0.5023. We'll go for B. Okay. What's the matter? Questions on this? No. Okay. So let's go to 17. So from the Stata output where we just looked, this is related, two sample t-tests with equal variances, which of the following best describes the computation of the standard error that is used in the denominator of the test statistic? We actually did that. Let's go back and look. This 0.9337208 is the standard error that's assuming what? Equal variance, so we're pooling. So it's the square root of SP squared over N1 plus SP squared over N2, where all that the SP squared or pooled variance is a weighted average of the two. So if we go back to 17, is there anything that looks like that we've weighted these? So we pool them into a single sample. No, we don't pool them into a single sample. Do we pool all of the observations into a single sample and do something else? No. Do we? No, wait. So when it says pool all of the observations into a single sample and compute a sample standard deviation from that sample, it's saying combine samples, combine the observations. We don't do that when we get a pooled variance. It's a weighted average. So pooling everything together, although you see that word pool, this would be saying take all of the men, the 54 men, take all of the women, there were 54 women and 43 men, have a total sample of 97, and what A is saying, calculate a sample standard deviation in which you're looking at X minus X bar over the entire sample degrees of freedom, 97 minus 1, and the square root of that. That's what A is trying to get at, pooling, meaning combining all of them into one sample. That's not what we do with pooled variance. We're getting a weighted average. So A is not correct. B says do the same thing with taking it as a single sample and then calculate the standard error separately. So This is almost correct, except for the fact that it's not a weighted average. What is it doing? It's giving equal weight to each of the observations in this combined sample. So that's not what is going on. The next one says, compute the sample variances separately and create a weighted average with weights approximately equal to the respective sample sizes. So it says here, get the weighted average and divide it by the square root of 97. It's almost okay, except that it's taken the total degrees of freedom as the total sample size. So that's not correct because of this part. Then it says, compute the sample variances separately, create a weighted average of these with weights approximately equal to the respective sample sizes, and then the standard error is based on this pooled or combined estimate over 54 plus the pooled or combined estimate over 43. So this is what we do, D. And the last one says, create a weighted average of these weights approximately equal to the respective sample sizes and then just take the square root of it. So it's not adjusting for the sample sizes. That we're looking at the pooled variance divided by N1 plus the pooled variance divided by N2. E would be incorrect because it's just saying take the pooled variance and take the square root of the pooled variance to get SP and just use it. So that would also be incorrect. So pooled is just saying let's take a weighted average, use that in the numerator where we divide by the sample size for the first group and then we add to it the pooled variance and divide by the sample size for the second group. Okay, just a few more, 18, 19, and 20. 18, 19, and 20. So do you want to do 20 first?
Yeah,
let's do 20 first. So, and then we'll go backwards. So 20 says, after the study that we've all been talking about is completed, the researchers analyze the data, both using the stata commands like the ones we just did, and then they also are implementing a change that we recommended in question 19. So this means we really can't do 20 without doing 19. So we were foiled a bit. But we can skip 18, come back to that. Let's look at 19. So for questions 19 and 20, suppose that the Sleep Heart Health researchers conducted a new study, that's bolded, in which a sample of spouses are recruited, so both a husband and a wife. Spouses. So these are sort of like pairs. So 18 says, how should the test statistic, which should be used for analysis of data from this study, differ from the method which is used in the stata output that we just looked at? So there we assumed an independent sample of males and an independent sample of females. Here we might actually consider that we have pairs of husbands and wives. Now, they maybe are not genetically related, but in what ways might they be related? So it has 0 degrees of freedom, but lifestyle. So if we're talking about sleep, right? So sleep, often sleep habits of spouses. Now, you know, this is debatable, but often they can be related. So if we think about that relationship, then what would we want to do with these pairs of husbands and wives? We'd want to reduce it down to a single sample of differences in the Epworth sleep scores. So, because of this notion of pairs of correlated observations, let's go through all of these. We'd do everything the same, except we'd replace the difference in Epworth score means between men and women with the mean difference. Now, what do we know algebraically? If you took the difference in means between males and women, men and women, it actually would be the same as the mean difference. This is an algebraic truth. Algebraically, they're the same. So why would we do this? B, the same as what we had but we'd replace the standard error appearing in the state output with the standard deviation of the husband-wife differences divided by the square root of the number of spouse pairs in the sample. So that says, take D bar, which is the same as the difference in means, minus zero, divided by S of D bar. But what's S of D bar? It's the standard deviation of the differences divided by the square root of the number of pairs. That's why B is correct. And C, D, and E are just all kinds of modifications of things that are wrong. So you could look at those. You could look at those later. But we definitely are reducing this into a very simple single sample of differences. And we're calculating mean difference, D bar, and the standard deviation of the mean difference that we get by the standard deviation of the differences divided by the square root of the number of pairs. Well, if in 19 we think we should be doing a paired analysis, then in 20, we're going to make a comparison between what we did on page 7, considering two independent samples, and the change that we would have recommended, knowing these were husband and wife pairs, to do a paired analysis. So what these researchers find is that the difference between men and women is not significant in the former case. What does former case mean? When we assumed independent samples, that was on page 7. But it is significant after implementing this change that we've talked about, which means, what's the change? Doing a paired analysis. And a paired analysis accounts for lack of independence, meaning we have correlated observations. Another way of saying this is dependent observations. And now you're being asked, what should those investigators conclude? Meaning, they're getting conflicting results or inferences with the independent sample analysis versus the paired, right? Conflicting results. So A, they should choose the two sample analysis as the more conservative of the two. So you should choose an analysis based on study design. So this would be not a reason to choose this. They should choose the analysis implementing your recommended change because it yields a significant finding. Never do this. Never. They should choose the two sample analysis as the one that is more commonly used and thus more interpretable to the scientific community, not for a paired design. D, they should ignore the two sample analysis as invalid because the assumption it makes are not met about independence, and they should interpret. What should they do? Report the analysis implementing the change for the paired. Lastly, they should declare the findings inconsistent and recommend another study. So, no, don't vote for that one. So if it's doing an appropriate analysis for the paired study design, we should be doing the recommended change. And then we're left with one last question, which was number 18, since we skipped around a bit. And this one is saying, suppose the significance level was set at 0.05 for a two-sided test of the null hypothesis that the difference in population means is zero versus an alternative that the difference is not equal to zero. Using the data in the output on that previous page, what's the smallest absolute difference in sample means that would allow rejection of the null hypothesis? So that says that we have to think about how we're setting up the rejection region. So our null hypothesis is that the difference in population means is zero. So the sampling distribution of x1 bar minus x2 bar is centered at zero. And we want to know what's the difference that would, in sample means, that would result in having, for a two-sided test, having 0.025 in the tail. So that means we have to figure out what's the corresponding t statistic that would give us 0.025 in the tail. Yeah? And how many degrees of freedom do we have? Do you remember? 97 minus. So we actually have 97 minus 2, which is 95. So I don't have my tea table with me, but you might have it. But if you looked, if you recall, you have 60, 120, infinity. So we would want to look at 60, probably. So does anybody have their tea table to look at 60 degrees of freedom with 0.025 in the tail? Two? It's two. So what we're going to do is take advantage of, we know that the standard error using the pooled variance is equal to 0.9. Can we round it to 0.94? You might not like that. How about 0.934? So we know that this is the standard error of x1 bar minus x2 bar. So now we can finish the rest of this. So we're on 18. So we're saying if this table T is 2 that has degrees of freedom, we're going to use approximately 60 because we would go down. We don't have 95, so we'll use the lower one, not 120. Yes, always like that. Right. So Lorenzo is saying, but is it always going to be like that? So our convention will be if you have a degrees of freedom that is in between two of them, go to the lower one. Always.
No matter what.
We'll just use that as a convention. Or go to another T table, right? So this says T is equal to 2. We know we have x1 bar minus x2 bar. That's what we want to solve for. What do we know about the hypothesized value? It's 0. The standard error of x1 bar minus x2 bar, we just said, was 0.933. So we just need to now solve for this smallest detectable difference. Yes. Well, we're actually not looking at a confidence interval. So the question is asking, what would be the smallest absolute difference in sample means, x1 bar minus x2 bar, that would allow rejection of the null hypothesis? So we're really asking, if rejection would occur for a T of 2 or bigger, then what would the difference in sample means be that would give us a T statistic of 2 when our standard error is 0.933? Are you all with me on this last one, Robin? Say that again. Well, so it's not asking for the confidence interval, because the confidence interval would, well, let's talk about that then. If we solve this, our confidence interval would go along with 0.025. That's correct. So what you're saying is, why don't we think about this as the upper limit of the confidence interval? Sure, we could do that, because we're saying if you set alpha to 0.05, then the confidence interval is based on x1 bar minus x2 bar plus the tabled value of 2 times the standard error. So you could certainly think of it like that. And if we do, we're going to solve for x1 bar minus x2 bar, and that would just be 2 times 0.933. Looks like that's about what, 1.9866, many units. 1.9 units, so that looks like it's about D. So I like the fact that you were thinking about this as being the upper limit of the 95% confidence interval. That is also true, but if we can also think of it as solving for the sample statistic that goes along with the table T. Okay, everybody. So thanks for hanging in there with me. Sorry we got a little bit on a loop in one, but have a good evening and look forward to seeing you later.